One. Thanks for coming out as we venture into this unknown territory of daily changes in how we can practice with virus precautions. Get to Ben to review our precautions at the end. But thank you, everybody, for being willing to, you know, come to practice together with that awareness of how to take care of our health and the community's health. That's our included in our bodhisattva practice. So this is week two of our series on the Heart Sutra. Last week we only got as far as the title and the first sentence. So we will bravely forge ahead. Last week's sentence was Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Oh, let's pass out the chant book so you can see this. I forgot to ask you to do that. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. And last week I decided that we'd say skandhas instead of aggregates, to use the Sanskrit word, because the English translations fall a little bit short and aggregate sounds a little bit like concrete. But the skandhas are the components of our being, as we'll see, we'll review in this Buddhist construct. And it is just a construct. It's not any more than Freud's ego, id, and superego have any reality. They're constructs to help us think about or understand the way our body and mind function. So we noted last week that this very condensed, condensed teaching is delivered by Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And the next lines are, did you all find it? Page what?
Four.
Four, thanks. Page four. The next lines are, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. So before we go any further, now we have to pause again and consider, who is Shariputra? What's he doing here? Avalokiteshvara is addressing Shariputra, who was one of the Buddha's original disciples. He was often paired with his friend since childhood. This is hard to say. Modgalyayana. Modgalyayana. They were said not only to have been born on the same day, but conceived on the same day. So they were brothers in the Dharma. They became disciples of the Buddha together as young men, and after decades of practice, they both died shortly before the Buddha did. And there's a beautiful passage where the Buddha kind of is grieving them, because they were, you know, they were his two of his closest people. And even, you know, the Buddha himself in his old age lamented the loss of these two men with whom he'd spent decades. Modgalyayana was reputed to be the greatest of the disciples in terms of his spiritual powers. He apparently had many extrasensory abilities. And Shariputra was the greatest in terms of wisdom. So he's chosen to receive this teaching from Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, to help him understand how wisdom and compassion are. I mean, they're called the two wings of our practice, how they open into each other, I would say. There's a wonderful... have you heard of the translator Red Pine? He does, yeah. He was one of the sources I used in reading about the Heart Sutra, and he gives this wonderful speculation about this Avalokiteshvara teaching Shariputra construct. And he tells the legend that when the Buddha's mother Maya died a week after the Buddha's birth, she was not reborn, not reincarnated, but she went to abide in a heavenly realm at the summit of Mount Sumeru, which is an immense mythical mountain said to be the center of the world. And there she lived among the devas, or heavenly beings, and became a deva herself called Santushta. Many years later, the Buddha had given many different teachings. And as you know, most of the Buddha's teachings are pretty pragmatic in nature. They're about our practice, right? But he wanted to teach the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma is a really difficult set of teachings about the nature of mind, the way the mind is constructed, the way the mind functions. And he felt it was too difficult for ordinary human beings. So he spent the entire rainy season, which, as you know, is a three-month period, in the heavenly realm up on Mount Sumeru, teaching it to Santushta, his former mother. But once a day he descended and gave a summary to his most intellectually talented disciple, you guessed it, Shariputra. So he came down and you know, kind of gave this summary, which became the Abhidharma, which is a section of the classic Pali texts devoted to these teachings about the mind. And back up in the heavenly realm, Santushta, Buddha's former mother, advanced to the next stage on the path to enlightenment. So Red Pine makes this conjecture, and I don't know if there are any scholarly grounds for this. I haven't really looked it up. But he makes this conjecture that in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara is Santushta, the Buddha's former mother, giving these teachings to Shariputra. Because it is she who has this true understanding of the Abhidharma from the Buddha. It's not for me to judge whether his speculation is far-fetched or how far-fetched it is, but I find it really poignant, this legend that the Buddha goes, you know, all the way to this mountaintop to find his mother and give her his most difficult teaching. After all, don't we all want our parents to be enlightened, to free them from suffering, so that they can love us unconditionally the way we would wish they could? It's a deep wish we have for our parents to be free from suffering, right? And so I find this sort of an archetypal story about the Buddha attending to his mother, you know, whom he lost, you know, as an infant. There's a slightly longer version of the Heart Sutra that begins with the Buddha sitting in meditation on Vulture Peak among his disciples. And at the moment he enters deep samadhi, Avalokiteshvara sees that all five skandhas are empty. And Shariputra asks, if any noble son or daughter were to practice the deep practice of Prajnaparamita, how should they be instructed? And then Avalokiteshvara speaks the Heart Sutra. So in the longer version, Shariputra requests the teaching. So the answer, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness is self-form. So you remember from last week that form is the first of the five skandhas in the Buddhist concept of this, you know, makeup of our being, the form. Form is the material world, it's our bodies. Right? And emptiness does not mean nothingness, but rather boundlessness, non-separateness, that all existence only exists in this boundless matrix of other existences, of interconnection. So emptiness maybe isn't the greatest translation because of the associations we have with nihilism and despair. So boundlessness is, if you would prefer to use that word, please do if it's helpful. And the Heart Sutra expressed this teaching long before quantum physics taught us that particles and waves do not differ. The Buddha used the metaphor of the sea and waves. Waves arise from and subside into the sea. They're not separate from it. Or from each other, except as temporary arisings and passings. As George Leonard, I don't know if anybody remembers George Leonard from the days of Esalen Institute, the human potential movement back in the, I don't know, 70s or something. He said, there is only the dance. There is only the dance. So we must not get stuck in form or in emptiness, is what Avalokiteshvara is reminding us. Because if we do, we can't dance. So we follow the middle way. One of the commentaries, Red Pine, well, the good thing about Red Pine's work is that he also translates several of the old Chinese commentaries on the Heart Sutra, and one of them says, ordinary people can't conceive of emptiness without eliminating form. Bodhisattvas, regardless of the phenomena, understand that form and emptiness share the same body. Form and emptiness share the same body. Avalokiteshvara continues, sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So those are the other four of the five skandhas. Right? Forms, formations, sensations, perceptions. So wait a minute. What's it say in your...
Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness.
Thank you. And they are all empty. They are all boundless. They only exist as they manifest in interrelationship with each other. So then, Avalokiteshvara expands that statement even further. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So the word dharma here, usually when we say dharma, we're referring to the teachings of the Buddha. The dharma here means phenomenon. A manifestation. So every phenomenon in the universe is marked by emptiness, is boundlessly interconnected. That's all this, basically what this is saying. And then there are these three pairs of statements. All dharmas neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Dharmas appear to arise and cease, right? You know, we're born and we die. But from the perspective of boundlessness, there is no birth or death, just a flow of constant change. Impermanence, too, is empty, boundless. To tweak the law of conservation of mass, we could say dharmas are neither created nor destroyed. Yeah? And then the next pair, there's...
Neither defiled nor pure.
Defilement here refers to states of suffering, states of delusion. Purity, states free of suffering, free of delusion. And basically, these pairs only exist because with one, without one, there can't be the other, right? They're inextricable. They're not, these pairs are not separate from each other. Of course, we don't want suffering. And of course, we do want freedom from suffering. But in the light of Prajnaparamita, or wisdom, there is no such duality. So dharmas cannot be purified or defiled. There's just the flow, just the dance. Things we want or don't want seem to increase or decrease, but the wisdom of boundless, in the wisdom of boundlessness, there is no gain, no loss. No self-existence that can have or be more or less. Right? That's in our relative existence, of course, we perceive more or less. We perceive birth and death. We perceive duality and purity. But it can't be fixed ever, ever. So maybe this Prajnaparamita, this perfection of wisdom, can help us not to grasp so desperately for what we want to hang on to, and not to flee so desperately from what we want to get away from. So a mindfulness practice you might want to try this coming week is to notice whenever the stickiness, the self-clinging arises, whenever you catch yourself making a separation between self and other, me and not me, mine and not mine. Or you could do it with what are called the eight worldly dharmas: pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. Right? There can't be one without the other of any of those. So whenever you feel one of those separations or dualities arising, to just practice saying no loss and gain, or no praise and blame, or no fame and disgrace. This is a really good one. You know, if you feel like somebody's unjustly blaming you, right? Because no, we don't like that. Or if you're going, somebody praised you and you're kind of getting a little, oh, yeah, that feels good. You say no praise and blame, no praise, no praise, no blame, no praise. No. Okay, so the eight worldly dharmas. You want to hear them again?
Yes, please.
Okay, pleasure and pain. I made up a little song with these one time.
No, right.
Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disgrace, or disrepute. Sometimes it's called. Yeah, that pretty well sums it up, doesn't it? Pretty covers all the bases of misery. Or, oh, this feels so good. Oh, that doesn't. So they're also called the eight winds, the eight worldly winds, because we're always being blown back and forth between them, right? So you get the idea. You might just want to try this and experiment, see what happens when you realize that you're being blown, right? They just say, no praise, no blame. Just see what happens. And this is not something you're trying to like bludgeon yourself with. You're doing this with a smile, and with Avalokiteshvara's compassion. Just see what happens. But let's go on to the very next line, because this is a really fun part, I think. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to bring you the handout.
Oh,
remember the handout from last week?
Yeah.
Whew!
Oh,
I left it home. Sorry. I'll bring it. Maybe bring it next time. Fred has his.
Fred has the right idea.
Anyway, it gives you these, these categories. But don't worry about that. This shows these 18 elements that constitute the way we perceive our environment through our senses. right? As formulated, and this is all in the Abhidharma, they're the six sense organs, or powers: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. And body is the all the touch receptors, which are both outside and inside us. And then the six. Interesting to note that the mind itself is considered a sense organ, and what it senses are thoughts. Right, the mind perceiving our thoughts, our mind content. And then there are the domains or sense fields, so that's sight, sound, sight, smell, taste, touch, and thought. And then the third set are called the realms of consciousness, within which these sense organs perceive the environment. So when Avalokiteshvara says, no realm of sight, ... no realm of mind consciousness, that's including all of them, all those. Okay, so some versions say no realm of sight and so forth until no realm of mind consciousness. So all of these are empty too, right? There's an old Zen story about Dongshan, who founded this school of Zen in China when he was a boy, just entering monastic training as a young boy. When he came to this line in the Heart Sutra, I had no eyes, no ears, no nose. He felt his face, and he said to his teacher, "But I have eyes, I have ears, and a nose, and a tongue. Why does the sutra say I don't?" And his teacher was apparently greatly impressed, so impressed by this boy's question that he referred him on to practice with a more renowned teacher. So you're getting the hang of this emptiness thing now. What do you think Avalokiteshvara is saying about our senses?
They're empty.
Yeah, meaning?
They're interconnected.
Yeah, that none of our sense gates function in isolation from each other. Like the five skandhas. And what they tell us, what our sense gates tell us, is always non-definitive, partial, and ephemeral, always changing, right? What we see is very different from what a bee can see. Bees can perceive infrared light. We can't. Right? And what we smell is very limited compared to what our dog smells, as anyone who owns a dog knows, right? We can actually trust our senses more and less than we typically do. We can trust our senses more than we do, and we also can trust them less than we do. We perceive much more than we're aware of, and what we're aware of is less trustworthy than we think. Neuroscience and perceptual psychology over the last decade or so have really been confirming what these ancient Buddhist sages and practitioners discovered thousands of years ago, simply by paying attention to their minds. And they observed this. So a really fun book is this book by perceptual psychologist called See What I'm Saying, The Extraordinary Powers of Our Five Senses, by Lawrence D. Rosenblum. And he says the entire book is a lie. Well, at least the organization of this book is misleading. He says, like many books on perception, the chapters have been organized based on the functions associated with the sense organs. But now we know that perception doesn't parse so easily this way. You can hear shapes and touch speech. You can taste odors and smell fear. You can see speech and hear space. You can touch flavor and smell symmetry. And you can taste scenes and hear faces. Many skills we've long assumed to be the purview of one sense are now known to be performed by the other senses. And this is why you've heard of neuroplasticity, right? The way when there's damage to one part of the brain through trauma or stroke, how other parts of the brain compensate. That's because we've been using different parts of our brain to perceive all along. And so those parts of the brain can fire up and take on more of the burden because they've already been participating in perception in very complex and overlapping ways. So some of the examples he gives in the book that show how our senses work together. One is called the McGurk effect. The McGurk effect. If someone, okay, say I'm in front of Eden and I'm saying ba 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 ba, but Carmen stands in front of me and blocks my face. So I'm saying ba ba ba, but you're going va 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 va. 98% of the time, he would hear va 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 because he's watching this va 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 va.
Right.
Yeah. So we are, see what I mean? Yeah, va 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 va. Even though I'm saying ba 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 ba, he's not seeing that. Yeah. Yeah. So we are hearing with our eyes. And we can be deceived, right? Okay, another one. Very cool. He interviews a blind mountain bike rider who can navigate by echolocation, by making Whoa. Clicking sounds.
Like a bat?
So, point being, we actually are using echolocation in our daily lives and we don't know it. And the example he uses is, say you're in an office, your job, you're rushing to a meeting down a hallway through a busy office, glancing over the agenda in your pile of papers while carrying in one hand, while taking a sip of coffee from the cup in your other hand. How do you do that without banging into, well, sometimes you do bang into, but how do you mostly do that without banging into things? Echolocation. Our unconscious processing of the reflected sounds of our footsteps, other people's voices, doors opening, closing, all that without our conscious intention or awareness helps us move through space and avoid crashing into people, water coolers, etc., most of the time. One of the most fascinating chapters is about taste. Taste is apparently our most multisensory faculty. As you know, if you have a bad cold, it's extreme. You lose your taste capacity. People who lose their sense of smell lose most of their enjoyment of taste, right? But you might be surprised to realize how much your sense of taste is influenced, even distorted, by sight, touch, sound, and thought. So if I were to give you a glass of water with orange coloring, you would very likely say it has an orange flavor. And conversely, if I gave you a glass of clear liquid with an orange flavor, you'd probably report it was nearly flavorless. This is what all those grad students he tested indicated. And you all have a pretty good idea of how textures that we think of unpleasant, like sliminess or mealiness or lumpiness, affect your sense of food, whether it's desirable, sense of taste. But when I lived in Japan, I had this revelation. I realized that we live, how culturally conditioned our food preferences are, and that we live in actually a rather bland, we have a rather bland textural palate in North American food. In Japan, there's a great appreciation for like a slimy seaweed called mozuku, or grated yam called tororo. Like this, and they have wonderful onomatopoeic words to describe different kinds of chewiness and crunchiness, pachi pachi, that sort of thing. And so I thought, when I came back, I thought, gosh, our food's kind of boring in terms of texture. Yeah. And then one of the experiments that Rosenblum did that demonstrates that how mind can affect taste is that subjects given identical wine rated it higher when it was labeled as coming from a fictitious California winery than when it was labeled as a North Dakota winery. I don't even know if there are any wineries in North Dakota. But not only that, they ate more food when they believed it was a Californian wine. So I don't know what the Canadian equivalent would be, but obviously the mind made a difference, right? So our senses are also synced in with what he calls our muscle tendon sense, our kinesthetic sense, which is not listed, you know, in the Heart Sutra, but we can include it. One of the most exciting discoveries, I think, in neuroscience has been the discovery of mirror neurons, which allow us as infants to mimic our mother's or close caregiver's expressions, to learn how to, those first smiles, to learn speech, gesture, emotion. It's how we learn to read each other from our earliest days, how we learn to tune in to another person. Mirror neurons are our bodhisattva neurons, right? And they're intimately connected with sight, sound, touch, and movement. So, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind are empty, are boundless. I like boundless. And observing how our senses, the sense objects and sensory consciousness realms function is a wonderful way to begin to apprehend what boundlessness means here in the Heart Sutra. So maybe pay attention to your senses this coming week. See how they both enlighten you and delude you. You might want to do some sensory meditations in various locations. Sitting, walking, standing, see what you observe. The point of looking deeply into the boundlessness of our senses, including our mind, is not to write them off and say that what they tell us is merely delusion. It's just that what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think, as I said, is never definitive. It's always partial. It's always changing. Buddha's teachings refer to these, to our perceptions, as being like dreams or illusions, and in a way they are. But remember last week I told the story of a little child being stung by a bee. And if you said to that child, "Don't cry, that bee, that was just an illusion." That would not be a bodhisattvic way of handling it. The boy Dongshan was right to insist that he did have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and mind. But what was he supposed to do about that? I would propose that what we do about it is use our senses well. Pay attention, even enjoy them. They are the gates through which the world flows through us. Right? And we interact, so they're the way we interact with the environment and each other. This body, this life, is the medium, the gift that we have been given to help us awaken to our true nature. So we can be grateful for our senses. We can use them wisely, knowing and appreciating their boundlessness. Knowing that what they tell us is conditional and limited, but useful nonetheless in negotiating our way in this phenomenal world where we find ourselves. So next time you find yourself saying or thinking, I know what I saw, I know what I heard or thought, and no one can tell me otherwise, pause and be a little bit more humble and keep your senses and your mind and your heart open. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. And I'm going to ask you to get into groups and see if you can hear some possibilities. You're each going to have a chance to speak as usual. Think of an example where your senses deceived you or surprised you or told you something that you didn't know consciously, because we take in things so much that we're not aware of. Think of an example where your senses maybe, where you perceive something that surprised you or deceived you. Or think of a pair of those eight worldly dharmas, pleasure, pain, loss and gain, all those. One that you might want to take up as a no loss, no gain, that you would feel like that would be a helpful or a inquiry or practice to take up. Okay, those are some possibilities. Or just anything that you want to reflect on from tonight's passages. Okay, so move into groups of threes.